Ekhatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a concept that's really foundational to modern society, yet often operates, you know, in the shadows. Whiteness. Our sources are focusing on the structural analysis from academic Martin Lund, and our mission here is, well, it's critical. We're trying to move beyond just identity politics or, like, skin color. We're looking at whiteness as a complex, kind of constructed architecture of power.
Yeah, and that shift is so important, isn't it? Because when people hear whiteness, I think they often personalize it straight away. But Lund's work really pushes us to see it structurally through that critical frame. The core argument is fundamental. Whiteness isn't biological, not at all. It's a system, historically constructed, you know, designed to give privilege and set up a certain norm. The real value here, I think, is helping us scrutinize something that usually just flies under the radar as the default. We kind of have to make whiteness strange, make it visible.
That focus on the structure immediately changes the conversation, doesn't it? It shifts it away from, like, personal blame towards analyzing how the whole system is organized. But making that distinction, system versus personal identity, well, that's often the biggest hurdle for listeners, I find.
Absolutely. And that's why it helps to understand the person behind this analysis. Martin Lund, he's a pretty prominent academic specializing in education, critical race studies, and post-colonial theory. He teaches at Malmö University in Sweden.
Okay, so post-colonial theory, for listeners who might not be super familiar with that academic field, what does that perspective really add here?
Oh, it's crucial. Post-colonial theory basically means looking at how the legacies of empires think colonialism, nationalism, exploitation, how they still shape power dynamics today. And while, yeah, a lot of this kind of research can be quite U.S. focused, Lund brings this really vital European perspective. His work folds in these wider histories, you know, of migration, nationalism in Europe. It confirms whiteness isn't just an American thing. It's like a global power mechanism that just adapts depending on the context.
Right. Okay. So let's unpack that central idea then. The argument is that whiteness was literally invented. It wasn't just there. It was manufactured specifically to maintain systems of exclusion, of exploitation. So the book is really trying to demystify this system, yeah, moving us from simple ideas about color to a much more sophisticated structural look at how this whole thing was built and how it keeps running.
Exactly. And it's quite a historical journey he takes us on. Lund carefully traces the invention of whiteness. He links its emergence directly to things like the Age of Exploration, the slave trade, Enlightenment thinking in Europe. And it's around then that whiteness rapidly became synonymous with concepts like modernity, progress, even civilization itself. The sort of assumed universal standard for being a modern human implicitly became white and European.
Wow. And that setup leads directly into the two really powerful theoretical tools the book uses. First, this idea of whiteness as an unmarked norm, like the default setting, the assumed baseline you don't even notice. And second, that hugely influential concept of whiteness as property, which sounds odd at first, but means it's treated like a real tangible asset you can pass down.
Exactly. Let's maybe start with the history a bit first. Lund argues pretty strongly that whiteness wasn't some pre-existing identity that just kind of emerged naturally. No, it was an active political and economic project constructed deliberately by elites in colonial settings like early America.
Right. The sources make a point that it was literally written into early colonial laws. It was manufactured precisely to create a hierarchy, you know, to divide groups like indentured servants from enslaved people, justifying subjugation, stopping them uniting against the economic system.
And once it was invented, it needed a way to keep its dominance without constantly drawing attention to itself as racial. Which brings us to that second idea, the unmarked norm, invisibility and privilege. The primary power of this system is, well, it's invisibility. It presents itself as raceless or universal or just normal. So if you're white, your race often isn't the main thing defining how institutions see you or how you just, you know, move through the world.
The examples used to show this invisibility are just so, yeah, telling. Like the simple flesh-colored crayon you might remember from school. That one little thing carries this huge implicit assumption that white skin is the default flesh, the universal human skin that doesn't need any other label.
It's like the background noise. It gives us enormous privilege of often not having to think about race, the ability to just assume that institutions, media, culture are generally centered around your experience.
Okay, now here's where the analysis gets really sharp, I think. When we connect that invisibility to actual real-world impact, that's the section on whiteness as property. This is where the abstract idea turns into tangible, material, even financial advantages. We are privileged a lot. But why do Lund and critical legal theory insist on using the term property?
That's a really good question, and the difference is actually key. Privilege is often seen as like a benefit you just happen to have. But property is an asset you own, something you can potentially legally protect and pass down. Lund builds on legal scholarship showing that the very status of being white conferred actual, concrete legal rights in housing, education, legal protection that function like a really valuable, inheritable asset, a kind of social and financial capital.
And the sources show clear evidence of this property interest being legally backed up, right?
Mm.
Like the GI Bill after World War II is mentioned as a prime, almost devastating example.
Absolutely devastating. The GI Bill was supposed to help all veterans, funding education, housing loans, a great idea on paper. But because of existing racist housing covenants, segregationist policies like redlining, these huge financial benefits were overwhelmingly channeled to white veterans. Black veterans were largely shut out. So this one piece of legislation directly created these massive gaps in intergenerational wealth that we still see today. It basically proved that whiteness was a necessary requirement to access that financial property.
That connection is just,
oh,
wow, so powerful and stark. Okay, finally, we need to look at the psychological stuff that protects this property interest today. The section on the effective and psychological dimensions.
Yeah, this is critical too, because the system isn't just upheld by laws on paper. It's maintained by deep emotional investments. So when that status, that property interest, gets challenged when the unmarked norm is actually pointed out, you often see these really strong emotional defenses flare up. This is where concepts like white fragility come into play, which is essentially describing that defensiveness, the discomfort, the denial that can arise when a white person's racial privilege is questioned.
And this emotional side connects right into the last big piece, the adaptability of whiteness, how the system keeps its power by constantly changing shape, which makes anti-racist work so incredibly demanding.
Precisely. When, you know, overt, blatant racism becomes socially unacceptable, the system just adapts. It starts using seemingly race-neutral language. Think about colorblind racism, this idea that if we just pretend not to see race, inequality will magically disappear. Lund argues this is, well, deeply flawed, because refusing to see race now only protects that invisible default setting we talked about. It ensures the advantages built up by the system remain untouched. It's like a target that keeps moving, you know? It requires constant, really sophisticated vigilance to keep track of.
That analysis is incredibly helpful, I think. So let's try and boil this down. What are the three biggest themes or messages from Lund's analysis for you, the listener? Theme one feels like the absolute foundation. Whiteness is a social construct, not a biological fact.
Yeah, and the reflection that comes with that is actually empowering, isn't it? If whiteness was created by people deliberately to build a hierarchy, well, then it's contingent. It's not permanent, and therefore, theoretically, it can be dismantled. It strips whiteness of any claim to being natural or universal.
Okay, theme two, then, is about the invisibility and normativity of whiteness.
Yeah.
That paradox, right? That the thing pretending to be universal is actually very specific.
Mm-hmm. And this theme explains why just relying on individual goodwill or simply pushing for that color blindness we just mentioned is, well, it's not enough. Those approaches fail because they ignore the default setting that's already in place, the structural power that organized the whole system to begin with. You can't fix a rigged game just by pretending not to see who's winning.
Right. And finally, theme three, really driving home the material and economic reality, how this abstract idea has real, tangible, often financial consequences.
Yeah, it directly connects that history of exploitation, the legal structures of segregation, redlining, denying citizenship rights. It connects that directly to the disparities we see today in wealth, access to good education, social capital. Whiteness isn't just some abstract idea floating around. It functions like a kind of financial inheritance that keeps transferring advantage across generations.
Okay, to help these, let's face it, quite dense ideas stick, let's revisit some of those really powerful summarizing ideas from the sources, those notable quotes or core statements that just nail it.
Yeah, these are the lines that really pull it all together. The first key idea really highlights the power dynamic and the camouflage it uses. Whiteness is not the absence of race, but the presence of racial power disguised as neutrality.
That perfectly sums up the strategy, doesn't it? It actively takes the center stage in the racial system, but manages to claim it's just objective, neutral ground, like wearing a neutral mask while actually running the whole show. And the second idea speaks to why the system persists and why we can't afford to get complacent. The genius of whiteness lies not in its stability, but in its adaptability. its capacity to evolve while maintaining essential hierarchies.
That quote is such a wake-up call. It really emphasizes that fighting racism can't be a one-off thing or based on old tactics. It has to be continuous, always evolving, because the system itself will always look for new ways to keep its core structure intact.
And then the final one, which is so important for clarifying the ultimate goal. It separates the structural critique from any kind of personal attack. The goal isn't about destroying a group of people, but to abolish whiteness as a system of domination.
Exactly. The critique is fundamentally structural. It's aiming for liberation for everyone from being confined by this unjust hierarchy.
Okay, so that's the theory. How do we take this, you know, quite high-level academic framework and actually apply it in our daily lives? For you, the listener, looking for a quick application.
Well, one way is to use this lens to look at professional or educational settings. Like next time you hear people talking about standards of professionalism or maybe culture fit in your workplace, ask yourself, are these standards maybe implicitly based on white middle-class norms, even unintentionally?
And if they are, Lund's work suggests they're likely leading to unfair outcomes in hiring or promotions. Doesn't matter what anyone's conscious intentions are. It's that invisible norm being enforced again.
Definitely. And think about media, too. When you're consuming media, critically examine popular culture. Ask, whose stories get told as universal? You know, the default main character anyone is supposed to relate to, and whose stories are always marked as niche or ethnic, requiring some specific cultural context just to be understood. The book helps you move beyond just counting faces to analyzing the deeper structure of who gets centered and who's pushed to the margins.
For me, I think the most valuable thing I took away was just the paradigm shift itself. Really understanding whiteness, not the people, but the system, feels indispensable for any serious effort towards achieving racial justice. It's like the sources imply you have to analyze the architecture of the prison from the warden's office, you know, not just look at the cells from inside.
That's a great way to put it. And that leaves us with a final, maybe provocative thought for you to mull over. If whiteness is defined by this incredible ability to adapt and maintain its core hierarchies, what would a truly post-white future actually look like? What specific, concrete, structural changes would need to happen beyond just individual awareness or goodwill to actually make that future possible? Something to think about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.